Hi, this is Dusty Wells.
And this is Dave Clark.
And you're listening to I Love to Tell the Story. Having worked in the Christian music business for the last 40 years and working alongside the record companies and the artists, let me assure you, my friends, we've got some great stories for you.
And Dusty and I started about the same time in the industry, but I've been working on the other side of the street with songwriters and publishers and copyright administration. But either way, trust me, between the two of us, we know where all the bodies are buried. I hope you enjoy our show.
I love to tell the story.
Love the Neelands. So when I was in high school, we had actually opened for my girls trio that Susan, my sister Susan and I were in at the time. We opened for the Lefevers, and they actually, when I saw them performing at actually in Dahlonega, Georgia, where I live now, it's amazing how God just works everything out. But when I saw them, they were just fabulous. It was right before they changed the name to the Rex Neeland Singers. So I had a poster of the Neelands, and they all signed their names. And I put that poster on the side of my wall. And every night I would go to bed. And this is the truth. I'd graduated from high school. I was going to college. And every night I would pray, God, if you can't put me with that group, will you put me with one just like them?
Wow.
And of course, 2 years later, I actually was able to go with the Neelands. To make a long story short, our group had opened for the Rex Neeland Singers several times whenever they'd come locally. There was a promoter, Leslie Chastain, that would book us to open for the Rex Neeland Singers and for other groups that came in the area. And I remember one night I asked Rex at a church, I said, Rex, I would love to sing one day, but I just don't know what to do. And he said, Well, I tell you what, he said, make a cassette tape of yourself and then send me a resume and a picture. And he says, and I will just see what I can do. And then you talk about the Spears. Brock Spear actually called me and talked about, you know, just was kind of interviewing me, but he passed on driving to Nashville. And that was kind of a joke between Brock and Rex that he didn't hire me and Rex hired me.
Wow. I never heard that before, but I can tell you why. It was because to get that part as the girl singer, you had to play piano too.
Well, there you go. Yeah. That.
And what a lot of people didn't realize was, when a song, so Ben would play some of the songs, and then the girl, whoever that was, would play the others. And what separated most of the time was if the song was in an uneven time, Ben would play piano. And if it was an even time, the girl would play.
Wow.
That's wild.
That interesting?
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
That's fun. The thing about it, though, is when you talk about the Spears and you talk about the Neelands, you talk about Rex Neeland, I actually traveled with Alvis Lefevre in 1980 for a year with the recommendation of Rex Neeland. Rex Neeland called me after my second year of college. And I had these moments where I would just be driving down the road, and keep in mind, I had a cassette of the Rex Neeland Singers. I had everything that they had done, and my car, it did not have a heater or an air conditioner, but I had a cassette player underneath, an 8-track player also, that I could play the music.
That's awesome.
So I knew every song they did. I knew all of Janet's song. I was a huge fan of Janet Paschal and Kelly.
Yeah.
They were just so beautiful, and their clothes were just wonderful.
I love that.
You know, and they always were just a class act. And so I loved them. They were my favorite group. So when Rex Neeland called me after I had just finished my second year of college, actually the night before he called, I was at my friend Kathy's house. And I was driving home, and I'd had a very good year in college. And I was a piano major and a classical piano, of all things. I can't play a note now. But and then I had changed my major to education and was completing a minor in music. But I had learned so much. But I can see how God orchestrated all of that, because when whenever I went to try out for Alphys Lefevre, he wanted me to read the music. And so to me, the shape notes and the round notes were all the same. So I read the music. And so then I got the job. And Rex just said, I think this would be great experience for you to travel with Alphys Lefevre. He had come out of retirement and had his own group with Mike Lefevre and Scott Lefevre, Alphys's son, and my friend Michelle Davis. So to make a long story short, when Rex Neeland called me, I just was beside myself, because, as I'd mentioned, I had traveled to see my friend Kathy. And on the way home, because I'd had such a good year in college, I said, you know what, Lord, if you want me to be a school teacher on the weekends, I mean during the week, and sing on the weekends, then that's exactly what I'll do. I just surrender to you. And the very next day, Rex Neeland called. Oh, man, and he said, Karen, he said, I want to recommend you to go and to Atlanta and try out for Alphys Lefevre. Wow. So I traveled, got the job, traveled with them exactly 1 year. And when Janet Paschal gave her notice, Rex called me. And he said, Karen, he said, Janet's leaving, and I want to offer you the job. And I said, well, when do you want me to come and try out? He said, you don't need to try out. Do you think you need to try out?
He says,
as far as I'm concerned, you're hired. I was so nervous.
Oh, my
goodness. So I can't remember if it was 2 or 3 weeks. I listened, just to make sure that I had the notes, because I always had a strong ear for parts and things like that. But this was the challenge with going with the Neelands. Keep in mind, I'm a fan. So I go on their bus, and I am living my dream. Let me tell you, you're talking about Cinderella. When I was wearing her clothes, I could wear the clothes. So, when I got there, Kelly and I were wearing the same things, and we would wear, the dresses alike and things like that. And I felt like Cinderella every night.
That's
because
awesome.
Here I'm standing on a stage. I could cry. I mean, I'm standing on this stage, and I'm wearing these beautiful clothes. And I'm singing with my favorite group, and I'm thinking, how in the world did this happen? And I did live my dream, and people would come to me, and at the very beginning, and I understood, because listen, I know enough about music that I knew I wasn't Janet Paschal. I mean, I knew I could sing the parts, but when it came to those leads, keep in mind, I'm so young at heart. I mean, I still am, but, I talk on a high C, and I'm silly as I'll get out, and here, I'm singing these songs, and Janet was just the icing on the cake. She was so smooth, and she just had this great charisma, and you can't copy that. You can't duplicate that. I knew that I had to be me.
Yes.
But at that point, I didn't know. I didn't know what I was doing. Rex would give me suggestions and things like that, but I was not the lead vocal that Janet was, and I knew that. And with that said, people would come up to me and say, you're good, but you're not Janet. Honestly, I mean, did it hurt my feelings? Yeah, I mean, it kind of stung a little bit, but I understood. I knew I wasn't as good.
Yeah.
I knew that. And matter of fact, I knew that for a very long time. And not until later, whenever we started recording the first albums with, that I didn't have to sing someone else's songs.
Yeah.
That's why I always I try to be conscious, even when with my group members, when they have to sing other people's songs.
Oh, yeah.
I do understand where they're coming from,
sure,
because
yeah.
they didn't choose those songs. But you have to sing them.
Yep.
And but whenever we started starting to listen to new songs, and I was able to have my own songs, things started shifting a little bit. And then Kelly, Jerry, and I, Rodney Swain was just such a wonderful, wonderful person to travel with, and he had left, and so I doubled his part. So then after he left, I didn't have to double the part. So, when you're doubling parts, you have to sing the same thing.
that, you know, I had to sing the same thing he was singing. But when it was just Kelly, Jerry, Rex, and me, then we started carving out this style thing. You know, it's like they were a little more progressive. Yes. We were doing Over a Thousand Tongues. And I would stand at night and just sing those songs with them, and they were incredible. I always said that I became a better singer because of Kelly and Jerry and Rex. They were so professional. They were so good. And so to go back to the college days, I'm so thankful for those college years of the theory, the correct harmonies, you know, things like that, because Alvis Lefevre and Rex Neyland were sticklers on that. They were very strict on correct harmony. So that's one thing that I took from them to New River, because even when part-time groups would sing our music, they would be singing correct harmony, but they didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them don't know what they're singing, but they are singing correct harmony. So I've always carried that, you know, through the years with New River as well.
She mentioned a song, Over a Thousand Tongues. That was really a career song for the Neylands.
It
took them to a whole new place in what I really feel like. I was at Word, and I remember when that song came out, I remember people saying, well, that's not a Southern gospel song. That's a worship song. That's a modern hymn kind of song. Did you feel that when you guys would sing it in concert, that it wasn't like a Southern gospel song, or did you, it seemed like it just jumped ahead of a lot of the other Neyland songs that they were known for.
I think that we were so ahead of our time that we didn't realize it.
Yeah.
I think when you're in the thick of it, because we traveled a lot.
Yeah.
So I don't think that we really knew exactly the impact that their music was making on the industry, actually, until years later. Kelly and I, we've talked about it many times. It's like, golly, you know, even back then, you know, we had to depend on the ear.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't have Pro Tools.
Yeah.
Or,
no.
And so we always tease about it. We always talk to each other because, you know, man, we worked hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, we could hear if we're off, did you hear that? I heard it. You know, or Kelly would say, did you hear that? Well, let me hear it again. Well, yeah, I hear that. We'd fix it, you know. And so whenever we did live videos, you know, we didn't go back in and fix videos. We just sang it correctly.
Yep. Yep.
So that's where the pressure was. Yep. You know, whenever you're on stage with these professionals, I could not sing off pitch. You know, I had to make sure that my pitches were good, and I had to make sure that I'm concentrating. A lot of times my vocal was so high, it would double with Rex on the bass.
Wow.
So a lot of times I couldn't hear the pitch. So I learned to concentrate on the pitch.
Yeah.
And that's what I did for years. And that was good for me. That was such great training for me as well.
I loved being at the Dove Awards the last couple of years with you. The girls from Point of Grace will come up to her and to Kelly and say, you don't know how much we would copy. When they said they'd go and listen to Neyland records, and it was because of Kelly and Karen. I've heard Lee say it. I've heard Denise say it. I've heard them all say it, which I think that just says when you said you were so ahead of your time. They were. You guys were. I remember thinking, this is Southern gospel, but it's really inspirational. It's Sandy Patty. There was a lot of that music that was. So I love it when those artists will come up and tell you that stuff.
It blows my mind because, honestly, it's almost surreal to me. It's like I believe them absolutely 100%, but I never perceive myself as that.
Amazing. So you talk about Janet and that role of coming in and no, you're not her. And what you want to say to some of those people is, you know what, and she's not me either. It's a fine line. All you can do is what you did and walk away.
Well, I never thought of myself as this person that was just incredible. I'll tell you what happened when I first came with them and I was rehearsing with them. And whenever they got the new album, there was a new album that was coming out. I came in June. The album was coming out in August. So Rex wanted me to take Janet solo from there, and it's got just an old rejected relic. You know, and it was just such a beautiful ballad. And when I heard it, I thought, oh dear, you know, I'm going to sing it. I'll do the best I can. You know, I'll jump in there and do it, but I know it's not going to be that. When I got in my car and drove home, I cried all the way home. And I said, God, I don't think I can do this. I know I'm not her. I cannot do this. You know, my voice is different. And so, I mean, I knew I had the parts, but when it came to the lead vocals, I just was not, I wasn't polished.
So let me tell you what I think you and Janet had in common. Both of you lit up the stage. You're both are great singers. You had all the charisma, and I don't know where the line of how much was inner self-confidence or you just knew you had to be that on stage. Here's what else I think you both had in common. You both played up the blonde, not ditzy, is that the right word? But you both are two of the smartest ladies I've ever known, and I'd sit with Janet, and she'd talk you up and down the stock market, and then get on stage, and she was this real light. The same could be said of my friend Karen Peck. Other thing is, I think you both came into writing later. You weren't writers to start with, and the more you got invested in the writing process, Your records were a lot more effective, I think. Is that how do you respond to that?
Well, I will say this: as far as the blonde thing, I mean, even growing up in school, I was always lighthearted and fun, and I love to make people laugh.
It's just fun.
It's awesome. And you know, the only time that I really start getting offended is when there's this, you know, the people that will treat me like I'm dumb, you know, or talk me down or things like that. That doesn't happen often, but you know, it's like I'm good as long as, you know, you have permission. I wear a sign that says go ahead and tease me. But the thing is, I'm very serious about what I do, and I am smarter. I've always been smarter than I act. But
I love that.
It's funny. It's really funny.
But you are.
And it's okay. I mean, it's like some people, you know, they just think, well, okay, I don't know if she could do this or not. But I will say this, as far as the writing's concerned, I started writing here and there. When I was with the Neelands, they did record one song that I had co-written with Danny Crawford, our friend, that helped us start New River. And so we did that song. But you're right. Later on, I mean, I would write songs here and there. Then I met John Rousey. John has been such a tremendous blessing to me and just such a, you know, a great co-writer. I mean, he would help me get the song to where it needed to be. And then later on, when I came with Daywind, Rick Shelton said, okay, Karen, I really want you to drive to Nashville. He kept telling me to do this, drive to Nashville, get in a room with writers. Well, there's no way. I mean, I didn't do it for a long time because I thought I would be so embarrassed. Mm. You know, because with John, I can just call him up, and I had co-written in a room before. Like Marsha Henry came to my house one time and we wrote a song called If God Says You Can. And then I wrote another song while I was with Spring Hill. But to actually drive my car to Nashville, sit in a room, I thought, I'm a tune person and an idea person. And Dave, you can give an account to that. I will sit there. But I know when the song is where I really envision it. But I'm a tune person and an idea person.
But bring, and we'll get into a little bit of that later, but you bring incredible instincts to a song.
Oh, thank you, friend.
And I felt like I was the intimidated one sitting in a room with you sometimes because you were so sure what you knew that you wanted to say. Let me ask you another question about the early days. So I'm sitting here listening going, okay, you left, you were singing with your sisters, you leave, and all of a sudden you're the one on the main stage. So what's Susan do during those years?
Well,
and was that a,
it's funny you ask, because Susan, she never really wanted to sing that much. She would just sing part-time every now and then. We'd start a group, or she would sing with a group I'm with, and she'd either get mad or get bored. Oh, I'm tired. I don't want to sing anymore. And Susan had a dump truck business. And Susan really was more into business. She wanted to have, she had a lot of stuff. I mean, she had done very well. And then she was singing with a part-time group, the Royal Airs from Ohio, with Jerry and Susan Metzler, and, well, Janet Metzler at the time. And so she really was getting motivated. She really was loving being with them. They would fly her to Ohio on the weekends, and then she had her dump truck business during the week. So when I was with the Neelands, she was always very supportive. I was supportive of her, and I would come home, and, you know, every night around 11 o'clock or midnight, Susan and I were talking on the phone. My other sister, Sandra, she has a family, and she did not sing. She can sing, but she never sang. She was pretty much, you know, stayed home with the kids, and she's a wonderful person. And but Susan and I, we always said one day we hope to sing together again, and it was a dream come true for our parents as well. So when we started New River, it just, you know, whenever I decided to leave Rex, I had married Ricky, and we were married a year and a half, and I was traveling almost 300 days a year. And so we wanted to start a family, and I knew I couldn't have a family and travel with another group. So Danny Crawford, that I'd mentioned earlier, had kind of briefly mentioned, you know, hey, if you ever come off the road, we'll start a group. So I'd remembered that, and so I called Danny, and I said, I'm thinking about leaving the Neelands, and what do you think about us just starting a group and singing locally? And he said, that sounds great to me. It took me forever to give my notice, because I knew that once I left the Neelands, my career was over. That it, no false humility there. I knew it was over. And so anyway, Susan said, well, listen, if you leave the Neelands, I want to sing. And then, and honestly, Susan is very committed. We've been together now 33 years, and we're still going strong. And then Ricky said, well, I'll play in your band. And then, of course, Ricky eventually went to Running the Sound.
And you can see, when you go and watch you guys now, you can see that respect from Susan.
The camaraderie, yes.
That would be real easy to be threatened by, you know, it's your name on the bus and all that. But it, I don't get any sense of that at all. Yeah. It feels real genuine.
I always said, I know she has to get sick and tired of hearing my name all the time. You know, it's like, because it's always Karen Peckney River. Well, we're glad to see Karen here tonight. And it makes me cringe, because, you know, there is no way this group is just about me. Yeah. There's no way. I mean, it takes a village to do what we do. Yeah. Susan has always been, we've always been close. We fought like cats and dogs growing up. One time when she was little, I was a pistol when I was a little girl. You know, I was the youngest of the three girls, and the two older sisters, they always did everything Mom and Daddy said to do. But me, I was one that always wanted to know, well, why can't I do that? I got more spankings by asking why. And so one time we had watched the Gunsmoke, and I was just watching them, you know, they would take the whiskey bottles and hit, you know, hit the people over the head, and the bottle would break. And so I thought that'd be so fun. I saw Susan watching TV. She was sitting in the floor watching TV. I took a Coke bottle.
No.
Now, that's full of Coke. And I went behind her, and I just hit her over the head as hard as I could. Susan went into hysterics.
No.
And
ladies and gentlemen, this is Karen Peck.
Yeah. And I wasn't being mean. I was just thinking, this bottle's going to break.
Wait.
And so
I wasn't being mean.
I didn't.
Did you hear that, Dusty?
Oh, my goodness.
And so I got the worst spanking. But I was very, you know, I was very inquisitive when I was little. Let me tell you.
We need to go to a commercial break here while the listeners get to
process
that. That
is absolutely.
I was afraid of Susan, too, by the way. My sister Sandra would say the same thing. Susan, boy, if she got mad at you, you're done. And so she would definitely.
Didn't you? She, there was a story somewhere about you tearing up one of her dolls.
Oh, well, I was playing hairstylist. And, you know, Susan, she wasn't playing with dolls, you know, at that time. She was older, and I always played with my baby dolls. And my favorite doll was Baby Boo. And so one time I just decided I'd take one of Susan's dolls, and I was playing hairstylist, and I was cutting the hair. And she walked in and got so mad that I was cutting her doll's hair. She took my favorite doll, Baby Boo, and she cut that, just gapped the hair all over. Yeah, y'all, I still have that doll. It looks like the Chucky doll. I'm serious.
Oh, my goodness. That is so funny.
We have all kinds of stories like that growing up.
So fast forward a little bit. So you resigned from Rex, and it's a whole new world.
Oh, it is.
Where did the name New River come from?
Well, Danny Crawford was our piano player at the time, and his wife had given him a sweater, and in the tag it said New River. And he said, you know, that is a great name for a gospel group.
Wow.
I always want it to be a spiritual thing,
yeah,
y'all, but it came from a sweater.
That's awesome.
So
yeah, but we really prayed about it. Yeah, we said, okay, well, let's pray about it. And so we said, we'll meet back next week. We all came back the next week, and everybody said, we really like New River. And so we knew we were new. Yeah. We were doing, you know, the song, Just a Little Bend in the River of Life. Yeah. So we had a little bit of edgy, little fun country flair because of Danny Crawford and his arranging. And, you know, Jesus loved the water, and we thought, well, okay, this will be good. So we took it to Eldridge Fox, who was our producer. Because we had, you know, a deal with Horizon. It was Pinnacle Records at the time. And he said, you know what? He said, I like that name. He said, but we're going to have to put Karen Peck on the front.
Yes.
And that way people will know, you know, where you've been, what you're doing. And I said, I was so embarrassed. I said, these people in this industry will laugh me out of this industry. My peers are going to laugh at me with my name on this group. And he says, well, he said, I tell you what, let's just keep it on there for at least 5 years. Yeah. Then after that, we'll drop the name, and 33 years later, we're still Karen Peck and New River.
What's so interesting about that, because I remember when it came out, there was not a lot of female vocalists that, I don't know of any back then, I was trying to think, that had a group. Because you're this woman, I mean, you had women who were in groups and everything, but I think you're one of the first ones that I ever saw that was Karen Peck and New River. You'd see the Nealands, you'd see the Goodmans, you'd see the Rambos, you'd see all these other ones. But it was Karen Peck and New River. And here you are, this woman, in this big boy man's world.
The stories I could tell.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, it was not. I will go ahead and say it was not easy.
Yeah.
So
we've talked about this at times. And
So when you start that, you had some name recognition because they worked a lot of dates. The tendency is, well, if I'm going to get a booking agent, the only one I know is the one that, if I'm going to get a producer, the only one I know is. I mean, you had a network, but it really wasn't one that you could go to, was it?
Well, honestly, I didn't have to, because it's just amazing how God works. Back in 1980, let's see, I guess it would be 89, I had a solo project come out. Now, I never thought when I was with the Nealands, I'm going to start my own group one day.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to be solo. It never entered my mind. Well, Anthony Berger and Mickey Gamble from Pinnacle Records came to me and said, listen, you know, we've got this label, and we would love to do an album on you. And Eldridge Fox said, you know what, let me talk to Rex first. I said, yeah, we need to ask Rex. So he went to Rex and said, are you okay with Karen doing a solo project? I thought, a solo project? I mean, I don't know if anybody would be interested in that. And so we did the solo project. Well, I had a ball. I had so much fun. There was so much freedom in doing that.
Sure.
And so anyway, fast forward, we started New River, and I hired Brian Sutton in my band. And so but we didn't think that, you know, when I gave my notice with Rex in August of that year, I gave my note. I would be leaving in November. They were doing a West Coast tour. They were so good to me during that time. Literally, I mean, you know that someone's leaving, but they were just really sweet. They were very precious. Mm-hmm. And So whenever I gave my notice, we went to NQC shortly after that, and word had gotten out that I was starting a group. I did not have any clue that I knew that many people because, you know, I'm a people person. Yeah. So I had met so many people over the past 10 years that the people automatically wanted to book us. Wow. Well, Elders Fox called Becky Simmons and said, "Hey, would you book Karen's group?" She said, "Sure." So wow. Elders Fox, Tim Riley, they were both on the with the it was Century 2 then, and so Tim Riley and Elders Fox said, "Hey, listen, why don't you let New River open for as many concerts that we do?" That was a shot in the arm for us,
I bet,
as being able to do that. So
wow.
We had the record label, and then we had the booking agency when we started. So wow. that was a big blessing for us as well.
Well, one of the things that I don't want to get lost in all this is Eldridge Fox was a pretty sharp old dude.
Yes, he was.
And I've heard what you're saying, stuff I had no idea. But I know some input and advice he was giving to some other people, and names like that that are not necessarily mainstream names, they played a big role in defining the shape of our industry.
They really did. Eldridge had such a tremendous ear for the music and choosing songs, but he also had the heart. Here, Eldridge had the Kingsman Quartet, and they were just in the prime of their time. So, I mean, Eldridge was a very, very kind man, but he loved the Lord, and he loved this music.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you this, and talking about Susan, he always called her his favorite alto.
Mm.
He said, "How's my favorite alto doing?"
Wow.
But he really took us under his wings, and he really mentored us in a lot of ways. And I want to go ahead and say this, too. I mean, we did have the support of Rex Nealon as well. Rex was always supportive. And so it was such a wonderful time looking back. But I will tell you, I was nervous because the thing is, I had the covering of the Nealons, you know, Rex Nealon. And, you know, I had been there for so long. And people are thinking, what style is she going to be?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
we didn't set out to have a style. We just wanted to be us. And so we started recording the songs. And I'll say that we carried that on over the years. But we just wanted to be our style. And I didn't want to duplicate what they were doing because nobody can duplicate them. They're the best. So I had to do something, you know, I had to just be me. And we just had to, you know, stay the course and stay in our lane and do what we were doing. And so it was trial and error. Made a lot of mistakes during that time, but we also made a lot of great choices as well.
What was the biggest surprise of a learning curve that you figured out being your own manager versus working for somebody else?
Well, I will say this. I'm having to pay the bills.
Yeah, sure.
Kelly and I talk about this, but, you know, we did not like Sunday mornings, but I got my own group the Sunday morning.
Yep. Yep.
You know, anytime the bus made an odd noise, we put three engines in three different, in the first 3 years of New River. I don't know how we did it, except the Lord. Yeah. He just provided the way.
You did that. You put that engine in personally? You were out there with a grease in your hands.
Listen, it's a miracle.
Is there video of that?
You know, I will say this. We'd hear these noises.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, you hear the cash register going off because we're thinking,
sure.
Uh-oh. But those were really eye-openers when we, you know, had to pay these astronomical bills to, you know, to pay the band. And you had to fix the bus. And that was really, that was quite an experience. But I will tell you this. The first thing that I realized too is doesn't matter that I've been here 10 years. Yay, because this gave me a platform, but you still are out there on your own.
Yeah.
You still have to, when you're on that stage, you still have to, you have to do the job.
Yeah.
If you don't, you won't be in business.
I remember Brock Spear used to say, and again, I never owned a bus, and if you had given me one, I would have had to give it back to you because I couldn't afford the upkeep a new one. But Brock used to laugh that it cost $1,000 to open the hood.
Yeah.
And that was back. And I talked to a guy this week from one of the well-owned groups, and he was talking about a little bus adventure there on, and it seems that that $1,000 has gone up way.
It costs you way over $1,000 just to pull out of the driveway these days. But it's amazing how, you know, we started the group, and I did not want to do the MC work because, you know, I just did not want to talk. I would talk and give my testimony and things like that, but I usually generally would have the male singer do the MC work. Well, my dad had gotten very sick. This was 1993. And Daddy said, you know, Karen, here he was in the hospital on his, like, on the bed, and I'm sitting in the floor, Mama's sitting in the chair, and he said, Karen, I want you to start doing the MC work. And he said, it's time.
Wow.
And I said, Daddy, I can't do it. I said, I talk on a high C and I'm blonde. I said that nobody's going to pay attention to me. And he said, you'll be surprised. He said, and then when you come out on the stage, you know, everybody always knows you by, hey. He said, you need to come out and go, hey. And I thought, I didn't say anything about that. I thought, I can't do that. Then nobody will take me seriously. So then Daddy died just a few days later. And we were just so distraught and so sad. And Danny Crawford was leaving. And Danny was a great MC. So after he left, I started doing the MC work. And then I just started gradually getting into that. And I started praying. I said, God, if you want me to continue to do this, please anoint me for this.
Yeah.
So it's been a process. I'm still in that process.
How long did it take you before you said, hey, y'all?
Well, I discovered several years later coming out on the stage going, hey, you know, and I thought, oh, my gosh, my dad must have seen that.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Daddy was a no-nonsense person. I mean, he only talked when he had something to say. So so he must have – he was thinking about that, though, literally on his deathbed.
But people love that about Karen. They love that about Karen, that she's so real and honest. Right. And it is. You come out and you feel like you're her best friend. And I can say that because I've known you 30s. We were both 12, I think.
12. That's right.
And thank you. Authenticity.
That's so sweet.
Oh.
The people respond to that because they know it's real. You can't become that just when you're on stage. So, Karen, you got this new group. You got your name all over the bus, and you're starting to MC. You're learning that you just lost an employee, so you're learning what that part is like as well. Talk to me a little about the label process, the record label. What you learned, what you expected, what you were surprised by.
Well, we had started, of course, with Pinnacle Records, and they eventually changed the name on to Horizon. So they moved us to the Horizon label, which was, they had the Kingsmen and the McCameys. Well, we started feeling led to move on from the label. And so we were approached by Spring Hill. So we went with Spring Hill. We were with them first let me back up. With Horizon, we had a lot of career songs that did not go to number one. But our first number one was in 1995. We started in January of 1991. Wow. But our first number one song was God Likes to Work When Nothing Else Will. Mm. And that was in 1995. Well, then later on, we go with Spring Hill, and we were thankful for the Spring Hill label because we had 4 days late. Yeah. And that arrangement to 4 days late, I can't imagine it being any different than that arrangement.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It was just such a God thing. And then we had I Want to Know How It Feels.
One of my favorite songs. One of my favorite. I always say it's my skating rink
music.
Yeah,
that's it.
It's
and
my
John,
favorite, one of my favorite songs.
John Darren Rousey and I wrote that song. And so we had that song, and we had a few others.
Yeah.
But so we, you know, we were, we didn't have any more number ones except for 4 days late while we were with Spring Hill. Well, later on, a few years later, Spring Hill came to us and said, hey, we're going to drop the Southern label. We're only going to keep a couple of artists. So they kept a couple of the artists that were on that label, but New River was without a label. So here we are without a label.
Mm.
And they said, there's a song that was on that last album that we did with Spring Hill, and I kept telling them every time they release a single, Please Release, Hold Me While I Cry. It was written by Gerald Crabb, and I love that song. I think it'd be great for radio. And they said, nah, we don't think so. So they'd release something else. So finally, whenever I got the news that Spring Hill was dropping New River from the label, they said, okay, we will release another single for you. That way you'll have a song out there while you're looking for labels. And they said, what do you want it to be? And I said, well, let's let it be Hold Me While I Cry. Well, the song went to number one. So we had a number one song, and we didn't have a label.
Wow.
So we had other labels that were approaching us and at the time, and we were just in prayer. But Daywind was always in the back of my mind. We had a chance to go with Daywind before Spring Hill the first time. Then they came back, and they were still interested. And I was so thankful they were still interested. But the wonderful thing about that is that they own publishing to Hold Me While I Cry. So it was just such a God thing. So when we came with Daywind, that was the first song that we had number one. That was their song. But it started a string of number ones. We had five consecutive number ones.
Wow.
And so that's when we knew something, this is special.
But you're 4 days late, and all hope is gone. Lord, we don't understand why you've waited so long. But His way is God's way, not yours or mine. And isn't it great? He's 4 days late, He's still on time. Jesus said, Martha, show me the grave. But she said, Lord.
Karen, one of the things, you got your start, you talked about the Lefevers, you talked about the Southern gospel background, and you have been a major force in defining something, a phrase I had never heard of, and that's progressive Southern gospel. Now you're in the Hall of Fame. You've done all these things. You've got 21 number one songs. You've had a career that's unbelievable, and now you're setting a new record that many thought probably would stand forever. Would you tell us about that?
Well, we found out a few months ago. From the Singing News, Danny Jones at Singing News Magazine said, hey, did you know that you are very close to tying for having the most number ones in gospel, in Southern gospel, in the Singing News Magazine? And I had no idea. Because, we're like everybody else. We're just out here plowing the roads, just praying the Lord will send the right songs at the right time. And so we had no idea. I had no idea how many number ones that we had actually had. But we did break the tie, and Dance, actually, that I co-wrote with Dave Clark and Wayne Hahn, our producer, broke the tie, and we have 21 number one songs.
Which we as a record company were a little bit nervous about when we heard it. We loved the song. Do you remember us all?
Oh, yes.
We loved the song. But I can remember walking away from that meeting and sitting there thinking, okay, do we, because we love the song. I want to say that again. Every one of us, Rick, Ed, all of us love the song. We thought, is this really the song? And then to put it out as a single.
But I will say this. While we were shopping for the label, we went with Daywind, and there were just so many things happening. And I was discouraged. I was very discouraged. And I remember just going into my closet, and I was bawling. I had a total meltdown just because we had just had a member change. The new guy was here, which was such a God thing, by the way. Devin McGlamory, he was just wonderful. Yeah. Devin had just come with us, and so I think I just had a meltdown from the year. You know, just no label. And it was crazy. So I called three different people and just shared with them my thoughts, and I was really down. And every one of them said, you can't quit. So whatever it is, you can't quit. God will make a way. And so after that point, things started getting better, and I just had to turn it over to the Lord, just from that discouragement.
Yeah.
A year later, we had recorded our album with Daywind. A year later, I mean, exactly a year later, I get a call from Daywind, and they said, "Are you sitting down?" And I was cooking dinner. I said, "No, but I'll go in the living room and I'll sit down." And they said, "You're nominated for a Grammy." I don't even know. I don't even know how it happened. But it was just, and that very day, I had a friend of mine that was telling me that someone had bought just all new PA system for them. And I was rejoicing with them and thought, that is just awesome. Then I had another friend call and say, "Hey, you know, the Grammy nominations come out today, so pray for us." I said, "Listen, I've always wanted a Grammy nomination, bucket list. I'm going to live this through you." So, yes. So I had gone to the grocery store. I was pulling in my driveway and I said, "God," I said, "thank you for blessing them." I said, "I know these things have not happened to us, but I just thank you for blessing them." And lo and behold, the Lord gave us that little nugget. He just dropped that in our laps. And so it was just the beginning of encouraging things. Listen, what we do is not about that.
No.
But I will tell you, I love it. I've enjoyed that season. I really have.
It's a good season.
So maybe one day we'll win. I don't know, but it's been fun. The journey has been fun.
We've done a few of these episodes with Legends kids, Billy Blackwood, Reba Rambo, where they talked about the mantle that they inherited and then they chose to pursue it on their own. Now, some of those questions come to mind tonight because you are on the opposite end of that conversation. You've raised your kids,
yeah.
And when you go see Karen Peck, you get the whole picture.
Yeah.
You're going to meet your husband, your kids. You're going to hear about your grandkids. And I just think if it was possible to make you more endearing to your people,
yeah.
I think the family thing absolutely takes that to the next level. Were there ever conversations that with your kids that did you just always know that was something they wanted to do, or did that come with free rent?
Well, I will say this. When I was a little girl, I remember going to the All Night Sings in Atlanta, and literally I was so small I could stand in the chair and rest my arms up against the back of the chair. And I can remember watching Vestal coming out singing "God Walks the Dark Hills." So I remember thinking, I wanted to cry. And I know that was the Holy Spirit, the anointing of God, that was placing that desire in my heart to do that. So my kids, because my kids were raised on the road. My kids, Carrie and Matthew, both, they've always loved the road because I love the road. This is, I think that it has all been in the attitudes of the parents. And I think that, of course, Ricky loves the road. We always, if we went to special places, we would take a day off and go and tour. So we've always tried to do that with our kids. I never made them be on stage. I did not want to force them to be on stage. Now, when they were little, they would come on and sing "He's Still Working on Me," and Matthew would pretend to play the fiddle, and he got that from, it was influenced from Madison Easter, just watching Madison play the fiddle. So Matthew wanted to play the fiddle. So it was really sweet. And But as they got older, I had a pastor out in Arkansas said, "Don't make them come out and sing 'He's Still Working on Me.'" He said, "They don't want to do that." He said, "They're too old for that." And so we got on the bus, and I said, "Do y'all really want to sing?" And they said, "Well, not really, you know, we want to play." And so what I would do is we had a nanny. I would let them stay on the bus and they would, you know, they'd watch their little videos or they'd go out and play ball. Many times we're doing outdoor concerts, they're out and playing ball. I wanted my kids to experience life other than just life on the road. You know, as Matthew always wanted to play guitar, Carrie was always very shy, so she never really wanted to sing because she was so shy. So when she was 16, both of my kids, actually Matthew was around 16 and he started playing guitar on stage, but he always wanted to have his own band. And so it's just, you know, when he would get with Bryce Free.
They would come to Word. Yeah. I'd talk to him and Bryce and Stone Carter all the time. I'd encourage him. Let him come to the Word and sing to me. I mean, we've talked about it numerous times. They'd come and sit in my Word office, and they were so good for back then. But they had such a love for the music.
Awesome. I always said that it was that Bryce, he would sing the lead. He sounded so much like Brian.
Yep.
You know, singing, you know, singing this music. Well, it wasn't Southern, but, you know, but I always encouraged Matthew to play and, you know, and not try to force what I do.
I would send him home with a huge Word goodie bag
of
all kinds of Word music.
I love it.
Need to Breathe, Skillet.
We homeschooled our kids. I did not want to homeschool. I begged the school system to let Matthew go to school and us take him out on Fridays and have him back in on Mondays. And after 2 years of school, he went kindergarten and first grade. They would not excuse him. And they wanted me to keep him home, to let him stay home with my mother or my mother-in-law. And I'm going to raise my kids. Mm. So that's when I started homeschooling. That was a whole other story.
Oh my goodness.
I was a drill sergeant and, you know, a drill sergeant, a superintendent.
Did you ever break out any Coke bottles?
Let me tell you, I felt like it a few times. Honestly, the worst spankings my kids ever got was because of school. Because I didn't want them to be dumb. You know, that's the bottom line. Kids were bright, smart kids, and I did not want to homeschool. I loved school. I wanted them to have that experience, and I did not want them to be dumb. And if they're dumb, it's my fault. And so it was quite a thing. But I'll tell you this. The turning point for me with homeschooling, I start with Matthew because he's 4 years older than Carrie. So Matthew got the brunt of it, but I realized the first 6 months, I kept praying, God, please give Matthew a teachable spirit. And one day it hit me, I'm the one that needs the teachable spirit. And once I just submitted that to the Lord and just gave it to the Lord, then things started changing. So we got our system down,
I'll tell you.
Now, I gotta say this. This is one of those times when I wish these podcasts were on video.
I know.
Because then everybody could see the fist flying and the
and
conviction.
There's
a passion. Absolutely.
It is. Yeah. Well, and those kids.
Well,
they're amazing kids.
Thank you.
That's what I love.
I will say this about my kids. They were homeschooled. Carrie and Joseph, Susan's son and my daughter, they are 12 days apart. So we were both expecting at the same time. That's a story within itself, too. I mean, we had all kinds of stories. We were sicker than dogs. We went to Canada.
I'm glad I wasn't on the bus.
I know. It was hormones everywhere. You know, Matthew was 4 years old when they were born. But it was like a four-year-old and twins.
Oh, yeah.
But those kids, they were so cute. And we tell stories about those kids. But they were really good kids. And I will say this about my kids. Joseph eventually, David, Susan's husband, he was traveling with us the first 7 years of Susan and David's marriage. And so David wanted to, he builds steel guitars for a living, so he wanted to go home, build steel guitars, but he wanted Joseph to go to public school and be on a schedule.
Yeah.
So they pulled him out of homeschooling and then took him to public school. Of course, my kids were still traveling and with me homeschooling. But I will say this, Carrie was 16. I had gotten laryngitis. Susan went to Carrie and said, would you fill in for Karen, for your mother? And just, you know, stand up there with her on stage and sing. And she said, okay. And when she was up there, she could hear parts.
Wow.
And she was right there, I mean, just in the pocket. And I looked at her, and she just laughed. I said, I cannot believe you hear parts all these years, because I would beg her to sing, and she just would not because she was so nervous.
That's great.
So anyway, I will say this about my kids. They are hard workers.
Yes, they are.
They love the Lord with all their hearts, and they've never complained. You know, if they made $10 a week, they would not complain.
Yeah.
They're good, I have to say. And I'm so thankful they're with me because they lived my calling, but now God has called them. So I try to be mindful of that.
So another thing that you and Ricky did really well is, Dusty, you work with a ton of artists, so you've got more insight into this than I do. I'm just a guy watching from my corner of the room. But when COVID hit, it shut the world down, and I remember thinking there's going to be a purging in our industry of people that I would never question whether somebody was called or not, but I also knew the only ones left standing, if COVID went away, would be the ones that the call was so unmistakable.
Well, I love that you brought this up, because I do remember Karen was probably the first group, and I love that I get to work with Karen. She's been a dear friend way before we worked together.
But the honor is mine, my friend.
What I loved is they jumped on it. I remember she was one of the first artists that said, we're going to do something in our home. We're going to open up. I mean, and we were like, oh.
I remember paying to watch that.
We had not thought about it. As a company with our artists, you would think that we would have. But Karen was one of the very first that there's her living room. Ooh, I got chilled. I mean, I remember those first. I mean, it was powerful, and I saw Karen go into a whole new place.
So where I was headed with all that was, they not only did that, but your kids found other ways to earn income during those times. Mm-hmm. And you know what? You give them both a good commercial if you want to right here. Did you kind of nudge them and say, hey, we don't know if this is coming back, you need to be ready? Or did they instinctively just go after what they knew they could earn an income with?
Well, my kids are very motivated, you know, when it comes to things like that. And I mean, we did have the conversation with the kids and Grant, Susan and Ricky and I, at our house one night after a Facebook Live. And I said, we're going to pay y'all as long as we can. I don't know how long it's going to last, but you're not going to miss a paycheck. You will get something. And they were so respectful. And I will say, even though they're my kids, but they were all very respectful. So Matthew has a coffee company. He started really getting into coffee. And so he roasts coffee every week from Guatemala and Ethiopia. And that company has done so well. He has really stayed with it. And he's been very consistent. He's got customers in our hometown. He, you know, restaurants. So it's really been great for Matthew. And this is what I love is, as we mentioned, New River is something that Susan, Ricky, and I built, you know, from the ground up. But, and then they come in, but they have really taken New River to another level as well, I believe.
I think so.
Just having them here. But then Carrie, Ricky has, you know, he battled cancer and he's had a lot of radiation damage to the nerves to his left arm. So Carrie, he's had a hair salon for almost coming up 50 years. So he asked Carrie, would you go into the hair salon and just help me? I can't raise my arm now, and will you just blow dry their hair and things like that? So she went in, and he discovered that Carrie has a great gift of styling hair and coloring. And so she's been an apprentice under him. As a matter of fact, she's in the process of getting her cosmetology license. And so she's been in the process of testing for that as well. So she has another income as well. So it's been a blessing. And then actually when our bus driver, Trip King, he was with us for 12 years. So when he decided to retire, Matthew and Grant came to us and said, hey, listen, we would like to drive instead of hiring a new guy. So we just paid them, which they need that because they have their families.
Sure.
It's just all, and matter of fact, they got it through the school system, and Matthew and Grant got their CDL license, and Grant does quite a bit of driving when we're home for the school bus and enjoys it.
I love that.
So, and I just love them. And Susan says this too, but I really believe that we've got the best team that we've had in a very long time.
That's great.
Their attitudes are amazing. Every time I'm around them, they're just, they live and breathe for this ministry. I mean, it's their ministry.
Yeah, things about them.
So you touched on Ricky's health journey, and you and I, you know, we may have met back then. We never really talked. If we did, we were in the same circle. But our first day to really get to work together was kind of right in the middle of what was going on at your home. You want to peel that back a little bit?
We had actually, Dave, we wrote Pray Now in October of 2014, around that time. And Pray Now, I was so happy with that song, Michael Farron and you.
It's a great song.
And it was just, what a moment that we had while we wrote that song. And then fast forward to, you know, a couple of months later, we're in the studio recording this song. We finished our vocals in January of 2015. And matter of fact, as we were leaving the studio the last day, I got a call from Ricky saying, hey, the doctors called me in. They want to do a biopsy. So 2 weeks later, after that album, we finished those vocals to that album, Ricky was diagnosed with cancer. So that was quite a journey. But I will always say, Dave, that Pray Now was one of the songs that pulled us through. It was one of our theme songs during that time. Mm. That's why I'm just so thankful how things go full circle, that we had met years ago at, you know, while you were the Spears, I was with the Neelands, and now we're writing songs together, and it's amazing. Then Dusty, you're the A&R director, but you're a dear friend and a visionary for what we do. And it takes so many people to pull in together to, you know, make things really great. We can make things good go to great.
I totally agree.
Today is a pretty significant day. Today is December 5th that we're recording this interview. And there's a song that's tied to what happened today that, if you're comfortable sharing it, I'd love for the listeners to know kind of what goes on when you're not on stage and the real life battles that we all have to walk through.
Well, today marks the third year that my grandbaby Isabel passed away. So, you know, this day is, you know, my kids, Matthew and his wife Presley, went on Facebook and Instagram and posted a picture of little Isla Grace, who's going to be two in a few weeks. And then they just had a little Jack. And it just goes to show that God's grace and his mercy is so good. And he's got so faithful. We wrote the song Sheaves.
Yeah.
And I remember 3 years ago, matter of fact, I was at the studio just a few days later here at Daywind. My heart was just so hurting. And then I got a text from Amanda Crabb. And Amanda Crabb said, you know, said, Karen said, I've been thinking about your kids, and I'm so sorry that they've lost a child. And said, I was thinking of the old song, Bring It in the Sheaves. And she said, when we think about sheaves growing up, we think that it's associated with the offerings.
Yep.
But sheaves is also affiliated with grief. So in the scripture, I started, you know, reading the scripture about grief and how we will sow seeds of sorrow and grief, but sooner or later we'll reap a harvest of joy, and that harvest, that those are the sheaves. And I remember I couldn't get away from it, and I remember Dave calling you when I got home from Nashville. I said, Dave, I said, I really think the Lord is leading us to write a song about sheaves and bring back the old hymn, Bring It in the Sheaves, after 150 years. I researched the song, and it was written by a traveling evangelist in 1874. So it's a fascinating story. So then that was the journey. But I'll never forget, Dave, us writing that. you had written the second verse. You couldn't be on the first verse in the chorus because you had COVID. You were, like, very sick.
You want me to share a little of that?
Share that, yes. Mm.
So when you called about Sheaves and you started telling me, I was kind of laughing and saying, Karen, you know there's already a song called Bringing the Sheaves. And you went, yeah, but do you know what it means? And I said, no, I don't guess I ever thought about it. And I can tell you exactly where I was standing in Huntersville, North Carolina, when you called. And you started explaining about the grief. And I'm like, how in the world have I missed that all these years with that song? So we set aside a day to write with Michael Farron, and you and I were going to write that song. And I was excited about it. And my next-door neighbor is a guy named Jimmy Fortune. And I spent a lot of time with Jimmy. And I was fortunate enough to get COVID from him. And he got it from another singer. And you know how that kind of all circled around her in those days. So Jimmy would call. He felt so bad because he knew I'd caught it from him. Jimmy would call every day and say, how are you feeling? I would say, I knew I was about 2 weeks behind him. So I would say, yeah, I'm doing good, doing good, doing good. As the fever began to get worse, mm-hmm. and I knew mm-hmm. we were headed into some rough things, but I didn't want him to feel bad.
Yeah.
So at one point, as the story goes, he called and I didn't answer, and he looked and saw my car was in the driveway, and he came over and looked in our back window. We don't have, you know, backyard is wide open, so he looked in the window, saw that my bedroom door was shut from my deck, and he kind of panicked. And he called my wife, where she teaches school, and said, Cindy, I'm scared. Dave's not answering the phone. Cindy knew I'd gotten quite a bit worse with the fever, but I was going to wait it out. You know how we do. And so he said, something's not right. So she said, I'm on my way. I'll get somebody to cover my class. Jimmy pulled up his car. This is what they tell me. I don't remember any of it. And Cindy met them at the door. And they carried Jimmy carried me, evidently, laid me down in the floor of his SUV and took me to the ER. Now, all that's going on the day that we were scheduled to write Sheaves. So Cindy knew that. Cindy called you and said, Dave's not going to make it to the co-write. And I don't know any of this is going on. And you did something that nobody in this town does, you and Michael Farron. You started the song and then you stopped so that I could finish it when I was well.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. No, Dusty,
wow.
you would never hear that again because most writers wouldn't do that. They just finish it.
No.
So again, I don't know any of this is going on, but evidently when I get out of the hospital, and I'm thankful to be out because we have got some mutual friends that went in with the same exact thing that didn't come home. So I come home, and evidently you sent what you had started, and I got it. Now, again, Cindy claims I lost another week after I got home that I didn't know where I was. But during that week, evidently you sent the song, and I wrote a second verse and sent it back to you. I have no memory of this at all. And it is word for word the second verse to Sheaves. And when you called, you said, now, Dave, if I could imitate Karen Peck, she said, now, I know you're a good writer, but you ain't that good. And I said, no, I make no claim to that song at all. And that's your current single. Well, that's not what anybody would think would be radio. But you and I have known from the beginning that God's going to use that song, whatever it does or doesn't do on the chart. There's a lot of people going through a lot of hurt that need to know that there's joy at the end of it.
That second verse is sowing in the sunshine, sowing in the shadows, even when our strength is almost gone. Holding to the promise, God knows what we are facing, and He will turn our sorrows into song. And that's goosebumps.
Carry on.
bringing in the sheaves. We shall come rejoicing, bringing in the sheaves, bringing in the sheaves.
That's the power of a song. I'll never forget when the album released, 222. And so that our album, let's see, Isabel passed away on December 5th, 2020.
Yeah.
And then I remember whenever our album came out, 222 on a Tuesday. And Presley was home. And that's Matthew's wife, Presley, my beautiful, I call her my daughter in love. I love her so much. But anyway, she went to the grave of Isabel, and she posted little Isla Grace. Isla had been born in January, and then, of course, the album released the next month. So she took Isla to Isabel's grave, and she did this long post. Yes. About bringing in the sheaves.
I remember.
And I will never forget that as long. I cried because that took a lot for her because she, that was a hard thing. She went through a lot during that time.
Yes.
And so it's, you know, it's amazing, as we were saying, the power of a song, how a song can really heal a heart or heal a mind or heal just your thoughts and just kind of comfort you during these times where we just think, how are we going to keep going? But just the power of a song that can just give you that encouragement to keep going.
And that's why
we love to tell the story.
We're glad you were here for this episode of I Love to Tell the Story. Be sure and tune in next time for more with Dusty Wells and Dave Clark. It'll just keep getting better and better. Wait and see. See you next time.